Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Today on the podcast, we have Greg Stumbo. We were very excited to interview the Democratic nominee for the Attorney General's office. Of course, Mr. Stumbo has had a long and storied career in Kentucky politics. We talked to him a little bit about that, a little bit about his past, a little bit about the campaign this year, and kind of the stuff he wants to accomplish in the office if he's elected. So, you know, that's good stuff. Make sure you stick around to listen to that. But before that, we're going to talk a little bit about the Attorney General's opinion involving Janine Hampton's staff, and we have plenty of quick hits to talk to you about. So, without any further ado, let's talk about that opinion. So, Jasmine, the saga of Lieutenant Governor Janine Hampton and her staff is a topic that we've covered at length here before. You, of course, remember that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dark forces.
That was part of it. Yes, I forgot about the dark forces. So just a quick background. Two of Hampton's staffers were fired by the governor's office. So, again, Hampton, the lieutenant governor, her staff was fired by the governor's office, and that's kind of the central problem here. And anyways, the reason that they were fired were for different and sort of amorphous reasons. One was fired for running for Secretary of State, which the governor said was against his rules. It's unclear if Mr. Nipper, the person who was fired, knew that those were the rules at the time. And another person was fired, Adrian Southworth, was fired in short for, I guess, insubordination.
I guess that's what you'd call it.
Yeah, we'd really,
in one word, I don't really know.
We didn't really get much detail about why specifically she was fired. It was kind of unclear also who fired her at the time. But anyway, she was fired for, basically speaking out against the governor. So if you want to learn more about that, we have a whole show where we talked about that in detail. Definitely go back and listen to that for more details if you want some of the salacious pieces of that. So to me, okay, the wildest drama in this entire situation was that Lieutenant Governor Hampton went to the AG's office to request an opinion about this. So, Lieutenant Governor Janine Hampton, she was expelled from Governor Bevin's ticket. He's running with Ralph Alvarado. He's not running for re-election with Lieutenant Governor Hampton. But even though she was expelled from his ticket, it's just kind of crazy to me that she is going to his election opponent to get an opinion against him. Just kind of weird.
Yeah, I guess why not, though?
Yeah.
She's not part of the ticket.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like she's,
supportive of him.
Certainly. So this opinion that she requested did come down last week. It was written by Taylor Payne, who works for the AG's office. Of course, Andy Beshear, for obvious reasons, wasn't going to write the opinion because, he's running against Governor Bevin. So
right. And also, there are lots of assistant attorney generals that write these opinions.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So to me, I think the central question in this opinion is very interesting. The lieutenant governor is, of course, elected on a slate with a governor, but that was not always the case. The lieutenant governor's office is constitutionally mandated. They used to be elected separate from the governor, and that's not the case since a constitutional amendment in, I believe, 1992. One argument is that since the governor and lieutenant governor run on a slate, that the governor should have an additional authority over the lieutenant governor's staff. You know, we run on a slate. It's unlikely that she would be elected if Governor Bevin wasn't elected. Maybe that's one way to look at it. She wouldn't have that job unless he gave it to her. So maybe he should have, authority over her staff. But the other side of that argument is that the governor cannot hire or fire, the treasurer or the attorney general's staff. So why should the lieutenant governor's staff be any different? Why should the governor have authority over the lieutenant governor's staff when they don't have authority over the other elected statewide officers? So the opinion that Taylor Payne wrote cites the Kentucky Constitution as well as KRS 12.02. And also KRS Chapter 18A as the reason for backing the lieutenant governor in this case over the governor. So KRS 12.0020 defines the lieutenant governor as a department headed by an elected officer within the cabinet for general government. And Chapter 18A defines the appointing authority as the agency head or any person who has authorized it by law to act. So in conjunction, these two things lead to the opinion that the lieutenant governor has the ability to hire and fire their own staff because the lieutenant governor is an agency and the appointing authority is the agency head. So that says that's essentially the backing for this opinion.
That makes sense to
me. I mean, it makes sense. There's probably, if you wanted to write the opinion in a different way, you could probably find other statutes out there to back you up. I mean, I think it's a little silly to assume that anything coming coming out of the Attorney General's office regarding the governor isn't political, given that they're running against each other. But I mean, I think that this,
You're probably right.
As far as opinions go, this one seems on solid legal footing. I mean, but the thing that's kind of interesting to me is that even though this, you know, likely is kind of political, this opinion has the chance to be quite meaningful. The lieutenant governor gets kicked from tickets on a regular basis. The last three governors have run with different lieutenant governors during their reelection campaigns. You know, Governor Bevin kicked Jeanine Hampton off his ticket to run with Ralph Alvarado. Governor Beshear originally was elected with Dan Mongiardo and ran with Jerry Abramson when he ran for reelection the time before that. And before Governor Beshear ran, Ernie Fletcher originally was elected with Steve Pence. And, you know, I think Steve Pence was accused of some very serious crimes and had to leave the ticket. And I forget exactly. Rudolph. I'm thinking of the name Rudolph. I don't know. I don't remember who.
maybe we need to edit this out.
Nope. I'm leaving it in. We're rolling with it. I'm going to think of this in the middle of the quick hits when you do those, and I'm going to tell you exactly who Ernie Fletcher had on his ticket when he ran for re-election in 2007. So anyways, because the lieutenant governor gets replaced on a very regular basis, this opinion can be pretty meaningful. I mean, if there are fights between governors and lieutenant governors because of, you know, political differences that happen all the time, the lieutenant governor's office is not the stepping stone to the governorship. I think maybe the last, well, I guess Steve Beshear was lieutenant governor, but not immediately before. It's not a stepping stone. It hasn't been in the past. These governors who are elected on slates like this do not often jump to the top job. So, you know, we'll see if this opinion does become meaningful as we go throughout time. Neither of the two staffers that were fired have yet been rehired. I don't think that this case is quite done yet. I think Governor Bevin will continue to fight this despite having the opinion go against him.
Right. And it's important to note that attorney general opinions are like persuasive authority, but mm-hmm. not binding authority. So they have options to, you know, file a lawsuit to actually get a true answer that he's bound to follow on this. But this persuasive authority has said that she can do this.
Yeah, absolutely. So that makes a lot of sense that, you know, there is some fight yet to be had here. Jasmine, in case you were indeed checking, Ernie Fletcher's running mate in 2007 was Robbie Rudolph.
I was pretty close.
I knew the name. I couldn't remember exactly. I don't know who that is. He was the state secretary of the executive cabinet and the state secretary of finance. So I guess he just worked with him. So
sometimes Robert's bad with names.
Yes.
And so that's why I said that, but you were right.
Yeah. Yes. We have a whole thing about me and names. Anyways. Okay. Jasmine, give us the quick hits.
All right. So we have some, I guess, super quick hits today because there's several of them. Number one, Donald Trump will be in Kentucky for a fundraiser with Matt Bevin next week on August 21st. Is this surprising?
No. I'll tell you what is surprising.
Okay.
We assumed that Donald Trump would be in Kentucky to support Governor Bevin. I'm a little surprised that this is a fundraiser and not like a rally. I would have thought that this would have been like a full arena, like speaking to a big group of people, and it's billed as a fundraiser. I don't know if there's a rally portion attached to it or something, but yeah, it seems like the main purpose is to raise money, and Governor Bevin's already pretty wealthy, so I don't know what the point of that is.
Right, but as expected, you know, Governor Bevin has been nationalizing this race, and so the president will be here next week.
Yep.
Number two, at Fancy Farm, a group of Team Mitch supporters, they took some pretty gross photos with an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez cutout that you may have seen. There was a photo that was posted shortly after the El Paso shooting last weekend, mm-hmm. and the photo features several young men like choking and kissing a cutout of her, and she saw it and she has responded. She said, "Hey, at Senate Majority Leader, these young men look like they work for you. Just wanted to clarify, are you paying for young men to practice groping and choking members of Congress with your payroll? Or is this just the standard culture of Team Mitch? Thanks."
Yeah, I mean, the Mitch McConnellites in the world, and this is not true of all Republicans by any stretch of the imagination, but Mitch McConnell does kind of attract a kind of like transgressive young man to his mm-hmm. campaign and has for a long time. People who love to troll, people who like to do weird and gross stuff sometimes to kind of get under people's skin. And sometimes that crosses the line. I mean, I don't know what's in these kids, you know, hearts or whatever, but I think that this is pretty bad. And I don't have hold out much hope that Mitch McConnell will apologize for the behavior of these young men, but I certainly hope that they don't do it again. So
yeah, and I guess as a side note, the Team Mitch Twitter account was actually suspended last week also, but for different reasons. Yeah. But they're back now.
Yeah, that was super weird. So they were suspended because of there was like some protests outside of Mitch McConnell's house. And there were some people out there that were like threatening the majority leader, which also, in my opinion, isn't a cool thing to do. But they were suspended for that. And you know, Governor Bevin was like yelling at Mayor Fisher. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was like, get your protesters under control. And I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that like Governor Bevin doesn't really care that there's like violent and people using all kinds of gross language outside of, you know, the abortion clinic every single day. But you know, as soon as people mm-hmm. show up in front of Mitch McConnell's house, it's crossed the line. So whatever.
Yep. So that's what's up with Team Mitch these mm-hmm. days. Number three, Matt Bevin has attacked Andy Beshear's faith over his abortion stance. So it seems we have like a little bit of a Baptist off, I guess. Andy Beshear released his first television ad, which he talked about his Baptist faith and that his grandfather and great grandfather were both Baptist ministers and how that, you know, guides what he does. But Matt Bevin called it insulting to the Baptist faith.
It's a little funny to me, Jasmine. You know, neither one of these men is Baptist. Andy Beshear is the deacon at a Disciples of Christ church, a Christian church. And Matt Bevin, of course, goes to Southeast Christian Church. So they're both like of a Christian denomination mm-hmm. instead of the Baptist denomination. And yeah, they're like, this is insulting to Baptists. I did see that there were several progressive people of faith, including, you know, some people that worked at Baptist churches and Jason Crosby, who's the pastor at Crescent Hill Baptist Church, that spoke out in favor of, you know, being pro-choice and Baptist at the same time. I'm pro-choice and Baptist. So, you know,
me too.
we're Baptist and they're not. So I think we speak with more authority than either one of these guys. And yeah, there you go. Matt Bevin is wrong. So.
All right. Quick hit number four. Mitch McConnell said last week that he'd be willing to consider expanding background checks when it comes to purchasing firearms. So this is a pivot from what he said before mm-hmm. about, you know, gun control legislation. He told Terry Miners on the radio, what we can't do is fail to pass something. The urgency of this is not lost on any of us. Presidential candidate Tim Ryan was actually here in Kentucky last weekend, and he called Mitch's statement a bunch of baloney and said that the history of President Trump and Mitch McConnell is that they try to slow walk this until it falls out of the news cycle. So maybe that is what he's doing, but this is definitely something new.
Yeah, I don't think that what Mitch McConnell said is bad. I definitely think it's a move in the right direction, but I definitely think Tim Ryan is correct.
right, the slow walking thing.
Yeah, Tim Ryan's like, I think it's kind of, this presidential election is a little funny because Tim Ryan's like the kind of guy who I would have been like really excited about in like 2004. He's like a young guy running for president, but we have so many different types of people that he kind of gets lost in the shuffle. But I do think that he's spot on here to say that like Mitch McConnell often uses a slow walk to try to wait until this kind of goes away. And it's up to people who are really passionate about some of these gun control laws and getting some common sense gun reforms in place. Like, you know, personally, I'm in favor of some of these red flag laws and some of these background check laws that have been proposed. It's up to people who support those to keep the pressure on Mitch McConnell. So do that if you are so inclined.
And last, you just brought up red flag laws, Robert. And so Senators Morgan McGarvey, Julie Rocky Adams, and Paul Hornback are teaming up to propose red flag legislation. So that's a bill that would allow for risk protection orders to take guns away temporarily if a person is an immediate threat to themselves or to others. And so people from both parties coming together to introduce that legislation.
Yeah.
We'll probably talk about this more when the bill is introduced. So yeah, it's just a quick hit for now, but definitely something that will be coming up.
Definitely something interesting. Two members of leadership. I think Julie Rocky Adams being in Republican leadership, hopefully, is meaningful for this legislation. And then Paul Hornback, being somebody from, you know, a more rural area of the state, I believe he's in Shelby County, which is still Louisville adjacent. But, you know, that's very interesting that two people from Louisville, two Republicans are supporting this. I think that this is a good example of how Democrats are going to have to get things done working with Republicans, Morgan McGarvey working across the aisle with two people who are like-minded on some of these reforms that are going to happen. So, yeah, definitely something interesting and something that we're going to keep an eye on. Yeah. Thanks, Jasmine. Great quick
hits. That's all the quick hits.
All right. Well, with that, let's get to our interview with Greg Stumbo. Greg Stumbo is the Democratic candidate for Attorney General. Mr. Stumbo previously served as Kentucky's Attorney General between 2004 and 2008. Both before and after Mr. Stumbo's term as Attorney General, he was a member of Kentucky's House of Representatives. Between 1985 and 2003, he was the Majority Leader of the House, the longest tenured representative to ever hold that title. Between 2009 and 2017, he was the Speaker of the House. Mr. Stumbo has enjoyed a long and storied career in Kentucky politics, and we are honored to have him on our show. Greg Stumbo, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. So after you lost your seat in 2016, it seemed like you were enjoying being out of politics during the tumultuous 2017 session, for example. We remember you tweeting a picture of your vacation in the mountains. So tell us why, you know, after such a full career, you've made the decision to run for office again.
Well, when I was attorney general before, I was the first attorney general in the nation to file a lawsuit against an opioid manufacturer. We sued Purdue Pharma and ultimately prevailed in that case. And now everybody literally using as a basis for their litigation the legal theory which we adopted. And for the last 2 years, I've had the privilege of working on the cases that General Beshear has filed through my private law practice with Morgan & Morgan. And what I want to do is finish the mission that I started. I want to bring these opioid distributors, these opioid manufacturers that sent over 2 billion pills into Kentucky over a 6-year period of time. And if that's not enough to addict every man, woman, and child in Kentucky by any statistic or any type of measuring stick that you want to measure, then there's no justice in the world. So I want to make them pay and be responsible for what they did to Kentucky and Kentucky families.
All right. That sounds like a good reason. You know, sometimes politics can be personal. And throughout your career, you've seen a lot of personal business become part of public discourse. And recently, a Republican operative even tweeted at your daughter that you're not a good guy. So, you know, growing a thick skin is necessary to live a life in politics. Tell us what it's like to be on the receiving end of those kind of personal attacks.
Well, you know, you have to figure out this business that not everybody's going to love. And the important thing is that you and your family know the truth.
Yeah.
And that you and your family recognize that there's a lot of good and decent people out there. There were a lot of good and decent people that were offended by those warrantless attacks, by those cheap attacks. And so that gives you the strength to go on. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on a similar note, you know, for some reason, Republicans seem to really not like you more than any other character in Democratic politics in Kentucky. And, you know, I used to think this was because of the way in which you ran the House as Speaker, but in the way in which the GOP has run the House since your exit makes you look downright bipartisan in contrast. So why do you think that Republicans have had such a strong reaction to you personally?
Well, let me quote Winston Churchill when I respond to that. Winston Churchill said, of course we have enemies. It means that we stood up for something in our lives. And that's exactly why the Republicans don't get along with me. I stood up to them, and I stood up for things in my political life.
You know, you have been part of Kentucky politics for quite a long time and have led the charge for many policy changes that have been really successful. Just a few examples are the end of the Broad Forum deed that happened back, I believe, in the 1980s even. You know, the ethics reforms in the wake of the Bop Trot scandal and uncovering the merit system scandal in the Fletcher administration when you were attorney general. So, you know, tell us about some of these items. Which items from your career in the legislature and the AG's office do you think give you the most pride?
Well, from a legislative perspective, the Education Reform Act of 1990, which I had the privilege of sponsoring, is a highlight to me because I saw it work. I have seen it work. I have seen it transform the educational system in my home county of Floyd. We were near the bottom or at the bottom 20%, and it's taken a long time. We knew when we passed it in 1990 that it was going to take a long time for it to catch up and make Kentucky's rural schools competitive, but it has. Now my school system, we have schools that are proficient, schools that are scoring the top you know, 5% and 10% in the entirety of Kentucky. And so we have seen something that was quite innovative actually come to work in Kentucky's educational system. The lottery, I had the privilege of sponsoring the lottery legislation. We've had the lottery here for, 25 years or more, and no major scandals with it. It's one of the most successful lotteries in the nation, which meant that when we put that legislation together, we did it right. From the Attorney General's perspective, you know, two things that I really am proud of that we did there was, one, we did three child predator stings where we worked with sheriff's officers across Kentucky and police officers across Kentucky and groups that would lure these child predators into Kentucky. We had sting operations set up. We had houses set up with cameras and literally with officers there who looked like they were 13 or 14-year-old girls. These predators believed they were coming to have a sexual encounter with a 13 or 15-year-old girl. We caught, I believe it was about 30 of them statewide. We got put on a national, we got recognized nationally for that. NBC had a series called To Catch a Predator. But the word spread through that community for those type of people, don't come to Kentucky. So Kentucky became safer for our children because of our efforts. And then I made a promise to a guy named Joe Curran down at Fancy Farm in 2003. His daughter had been brutally raped, murdered. Her body was partially burned. They didn't have any suspects. It was a cold case. And Joe asked me if I could would try to solve that murder case. So we did. We actually focused on it. We sent our KBI agents, Kentucky Bureau of Investigation agents, down there. David James, who was the director of the Kentucky Bureau of Investigation, I worked tirelessly on that case. And we finally got a break down to witness in California. Went out there. She broke down the minute that our agents walked in. And we put the people that were responsible for Jessica Curran's death in jail. And I was very proud of it because I got to call Joe Curran that night and tell him that justice had been done.
Right. Well, you know, when it comes to the education reforms that you just mentioned, I think one of the more underrated points is, and with the lottery too, which goes towards funding education, is how it changed so many lives of teachers, because so many of those people were able to make a better salary, provide for their families better. Of course, the education system is getting a lot better as well, but making those more living wage jobs and doing that job all across the state. So, you know, that's, I think, one of the highlights of Kentucky's legislature and government in the past century for sure. And, you know, that's a huge
right.
deal. So, absolutely. So, looking back from 2019, you know, are there any items that you think, you know, that you might have overlooked during your career so far that you wish you'd focus more on, or maybe something you regret spending more time than you may should have on?
The only thing that I really regret is the fact that we had a chance to do that could have happened is we should have probably made the Public Service Commission elected rather than appointed.
Mm-hmm.
In states that have elected Public Service Commissions, the rates tend to be quite lower, and with a appointed Public Service Commission, it's just too easy, really, for the utility companies to get their rate increases through. And
right.
that's the one thing. We had a chance to do it. Some people backed up at the very last minute, thinking that it was maybe done too quickly. But other than that, no. I mean, yeah, for the things that we possibly could have done, there's a lot I wish we could have done that, quite frankly, just weren't possible because we didn't have the money or we couldn't get the support. I wish that we could have funded and made the University of Pikeville a public college, because we need a public four-year college in Eastern Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
If we're gonna compete in the 21st century economy, we've got to have access to trained individuals. A college is just an economic driver. You look at the communities around Kentucky and Moorhead and Murray and Richmond, and certainly Bowling Green. These colleges drive the economy to a large extent in these areas, and Eastern Kentucky needs that to create jobs and diversify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, of course, it's still serving those people very well, but that would have been certainly a better thing, maybe something we can work on in the future.
I would hope so. Mm-hmm. I would hope that at some point in time people will understand that, you know, If you live in Lexington, Kentucky, within an hour, you can be in three publicly funded universities. If you live in Phelps, Kentucky, you can't be to one in 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when we look back on Andy Beshear's time as the attorney general, I think that two of his priority issues were definitely the opioid epidemic and also human trafficking, which are definitely super important issues in Kentucky. But what issues besides these do you plan to tackle as attorney general?
I'm going to reconstitute the Kentucky Bureau of Investigation. We created it when I was there before. We have trained sworn officers in the attorney general's office falling under the auspices of the Kentucky Bureau of Investigation. It's a very effective crime fighting and investigatory tool. We did things from seizing pills that were coming into Kentucky at a record rate. I think we confiscated more pills probably than all the other drug enforcement agencies, both state and federal combined. We had a room full of confiscated drugs. The legislature gave us a bill to allow us to do that, and we worked with the carriers, UPS and FedEx. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to go back and deal with these internet predators. You know, we haven't had a sting operation in Kentucky dealing with these guys for a while. I think we ought to set up some of those again so that our children will be safe. This internet is it has a very dark side for sure, and particularly when it comes to children and children that can be lured by these predators. And the thing about those predators that we caught, not a one of them really had a criminal background or a criminal profile that would make you believe they would engage in that type of conduct. They were the people that you see at the store, the people you see, you know, on the street. It's kind of scary when you think about it.
I'm glad you brought up crime because I have a question about that as well. Kentucky has the ninth highest incarceration rate in the nation, and our pretrial detention rate has doubled since the 1970s. And of course, people of color are definitely overrepresented in Kentucky jails and prisons. And we also incarcerate women at twice the national average. Is Kentucky's high incarceration rate something that concerns you? And if it is, what, if anything, can you do as the attorney general to reduce our jail and prison populations?
Well, there's two things you have to understand when you talk about that. One is that it's estimated, probably conservatively, that at least 90+% of our jail population is there because of the drug epidemic.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Fashion. So we have to strike at the heart of that. If we're going to significantly decrease our population in our prison system, we have to strike at the heart of the problem. And certainly the Attorney General's office can do that. You know, I've been an advocate for the restoration of felony voting rights in certain instances, or voting rights were being restored throughout my legislative career. But the real challenge, I think, is to make sure that we don't let the wrong people out of jail. Nobody that I know of who is of a reasonable mind will argue with the point that certain nonviolent offenders who are properly vetted, who don't have a very high rate of returning to prison and returning to the criminal ways that they had that got them there, there probably ought to be some easier way to get those people back into society.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, I think you have to have more probation and parole support. We have to have better information. You know, a lot of states are going to a more information-driven type parole system. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, as long as the questions are fair and we can, you know, we have a rational way of being able to analyze these cases. I don't want to turn people back into society that are going to be a menace to the people out here. I don't think anybody does. So I think it's going to have to be driven by striking at the heart of the drug epidemic in Kentucky, and also informationally driven by more and better personnel to do the evaluations on these potential parolees.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about your staff, we've been really fortunate to speak with several folks who have been career lawyers in the Attorney General's office while doing research, producing this show, many of whom have been highly complimentary of the way in which you ran the office during your term in the job. What principles would you bring to running the office of the AG, and how do you view the AG's role coordinating with the staff of attorneys working in the office?
Well, I was impressed by the personnel in the Attorney General's office. I can tell you for a fact, of all the, you know, there's about 200 merit employees over there, and which, you know, you can't fire them. that they're married. If I could have fired them all, and I would have fired them all back except one. I had one bad apple out of 200. And that is a significant record. I can't speak highly enough about the people that they have in that office. But, you know, I've been a practicing attorney for over 40 years. I mean, I've battled in the courtrooms of Kentucky, so I know how to practice law. I know how to practice cases. I know how to lead investigation. And it was so easy to work with them because I had that knowledge and they had that knowledge. You know, this office requires somebody who really knows about the criminal justice system, the civil justice system, you know, how to engage in the active practice of litigation in these courts. And I appreciated them and they appreciated me, and we worked hand in glove. We'd have weekly meetings almost, and just like a bunch of lawyers would at a private law office, we'd sit around and talk about everybody's cases. Everybody would offer suggestions. It was remarkable how much effort that they put into their cases. You know, they could be making a whole lot more outside of public service than they're making right now. They're excellent personnel, excellent attorneys in that office, and I was just honored to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And I do get the sense that many of the people that worked in that office with you were proud to work with you as well. So, you know, that's something we hope to see happening again soon. But, you know, the race for attorney general has become one of the more nasty races this year. So, you know, your opponent is a young protege of Mitch McConnell, and he has certainly learned several different tactics from his mentor. However, you know, you are also no stranger to tough campaigns and tough campaign tactics, you know, having spoken loudly against your political opponents in the past. So, you know, what do you think about this race so far, and what do you think about the campaign that your opponent is running?
I didn't expect it to be much different. The problem is my opponent doesn't have a record. Mm-hmm. He's not qualified today constitutionally to be the Attorney General of Kentucky. There's a real question, a legal question, as to whether or not, you know, if he were to win, if he could be sworn in. We can't find where he's ever practiced a case, where he's ever tried a case to jury. We know he has led criminal investigations. So he doesn't have a record to speak of. He doesn't have experience to speak of. So, you know, there's an old adage of law. When you have the law, argue the law. When you have the facts, argue the facts. When you don't have the law and the facts, you simply clap your arms and clap your jaws and try to confuse the issue. And that's the type of campaign they're running. They're going to try to confuse the issue because they don't want to talk about the things that are really relevant to being an effective prosecutor and an effective attorney general. That's experience and knowledge and being, as the Constitution says, a practicing attorney.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case, that he is very young and he doesn't have much of a record. It is certainly Mitch McConnell versus Greg Stumbo is something that I don't think many people would have expected much different from this campaign, for sure. But during Fancy Farm, you know, you received criticism for commenting on the age of your opponent. And you know, there's a long history of white people using the term boy as a derogatory term towards African-Americans, which, you know, you did not use that specific term, but you did comment on the age of your opponent. So, you know, is there anything you'd like to say in order to clarify your criticism, or to say specifically what you meant, or maybe, you know, just respond to that criticism in general?
Well, it was meant to be sort of a joke aimed at his lack of experience. I mean, he called me old milk. So did he offend every older worker in Kentucky? No, I didn't. I've never engaged in any type of anything but working for the rights of minorities. And, you know, I'm the co-sponsor of the Martin Luther King birthday bill in Kentucky, even though my district was less than 1% of minorities, but it was the right thing to do. And if Leonard Gray, who was the co-sponsor alive today, he'd tell you that. He'd tell you how hard we worked to get that bill through because there was a lot of ingrained opposition to it in the legislature. So I think my record on standing up for minorities of all types is pretty darn good. You know, I don't have anything to apologize about. I said it was designed to focus on the fact that he really doesn't have the experience that it takes to be an effective prosecutor. He doesn't have the experience that it takes to manage 200 plus people who are engaged in all sorts of litigation, from civil to criminal to rate intervention. It's a pretty complex job, and it's not the place for on-the-job training. Kentucky has this one chance, for example, in the opioid case, to try to get some significant monies that hopefully will be used for treatment, prevention, and education and try to do something about that. We've got this one chance to litigate these cases. And I don't think if you had your one day in court, if you had your case, if you had to choose between two lawyers, one who'd never tried a case before, who had no experience in the legal arena at all, and one who had quite a number of years of experience and quite frankly, fairly pretty successful at the task, I think it's obvious who you would pick. The Attorney General is the people's lawyer of Kentucky. I think people have a right, they obviously have a right to choose who they want, but they need to have the best lawyer that they can have in that job.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that makes sense. Probably just a little bit of a misunderstanding that, you know, with the campaign being as it is, and it's not surprised that anything small gets blown up to something huge. So it's good to hear you clarify that a little bit. So, you know, lastly, something maybe a little bit broader. The Democratic Party in Kentucky has changed considerably since your career began. You know, today's Democratic Party in Kentucky is more dependent on urban voters than ever before. Yet, you know, of course, Democrats still need a significant number of rural voters in order to win elections. So tell us kind of your thoughts about how the Democratic Party can capitalize on the energy of younger and maybe more urban folks while maintaining the support of the people who have historically backed Democrats all across the state.
Well, I get asked that question a lot, and I point to the fact that I am an old-fashioned type Democrat. I call myself a faith-of-my-father Democrat. I believe in the principles of our party, although I don't agree with everybody in our party. But that's one of the virtues of the Democratic Party. You know, we have a very diverse, big tent type party. And yes, there are people that I don't agree with in my party. There are people who don't agree with me. You know, for example, I'm a strong advocate of the Second Amendment. I'm a true hunter and a fisherman. I have been all my life. And if you look at my records, you'll see I've got a 100% voting record with the NRA and their endorsements through 30 plus years, through over three decades. But there are people in my party who don't feel that way. You know, when you look at the core values of our party, about education, about focusing on education, focusing on creating a working-class environment where people can actually earn a true wage, a living wage, helping people out of things like poverty, helping people out of low economic income situations, trying to lift everybody up together by creating jobs all across the spectrum rather than just in the urban areas. Those are sort of the principles that hold our party together. They're our core principles, I call them. We differ on a lot of other issues. You know, I consider myself to be a person of faith. I consider myself to be a very conservative. Look, I'm a Baptist and was a banker. Now, those aren't exactly what you call hotbeds of liberalism, you know, as a back then. It's the core principles of our party that I think make our party strong. And sometimes, you know, the Republicans have been very good focusing on a few far-left issues and saying, well, every Democrat believes that. That's not true. You know, every Democrat doesn't believe that. You know, I have people tell me, well, you know, I don't like Nancy Pelosi. Well, neither do I most of the time. You know, I don't believe in some of the things she believes in. But I believe in the core principles of our party. And, that's what we have to talk about with voters. We have to talk about faith. We have to talk about, you know, being a true faith of my father. The Attorney General's office is pretty much a nonpartisan office, to tell you the truth, because when somebody gets in trouble and we have to prosecute them, you don't ask them what registration they were. I put as many Democrats in jail as I did Republicans, and probably more, because, you know, we don't ask them what their political preference is. The Attorney General's job is to uphold the law and the Constitution that he's sworn to uphold, and to see that the office functions properly. So it's almost a nonpartisan type office. I think that voters are responding to the message because I think they look at people on the other side of the aisle. I think they look at people who say they're conservatives, and yet, you know, if you're really a conservative, how do you add $1 trillion+ to the national debt in one bill? If you're truly a conservative, how do you do that? That's not truly conservative. So these guys in Washington, including Mitch McConnell, who claim to be conservatives, you know, a conservative wouldn't have added that much debt to our children and our grandchildren's credit card.
All right, Mr. Stumbo, we certainly appreciate the time, but before we let you go, tell us how people can get involved in your campaign.
We have a website, gumbo4foraz.com. You can volunteer there. You can visit us and see what our campaign's about. We welcome everybody. We're a big tent campaign. And if you can't contact us that way, you can reach us through mail. Our mailing address is for the campaign is P.O. Box 54574, Lexington, Kentucky, 40555. And we look forward to hearing from you. Or I'm out there in the state. I'm not hard to find.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
You too. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @myoldkypod. They can like our Facebook page. They can listen to our podcast on the podcast app of their choice. We also have a newsletter that comes out on Friday mornings, and we partner with Forward Kentucky to do that. And you can subscribe to that at forwardky.com/email. And last but not least, we have a Patreon, and you can support us for as little as $1 a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.